Hi, this is Lex, and welcome to the FinTech Blueprint. It's your podcast about fintech, decentralized finance, digital banking, investing, robo-advice, artificial intelligence, and all the other frontier technology that is transforming financial services. To get more content, like an illustrated transcript of this conversation in your inbox, subscribe at fintechblueprint.com. So without further delay, let's jump into today's episode. Hi, everybody. I'm so excited about today's episode with Edward Woodford, who's the co-founder and CEO of Zero Hash. We're going to talk about, of course, fintech, as well as the crypto asset class and embedded finance. And I'm really excited to learn more. Edward, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I always love starting with trying to understand people's journeys into the industry and, you know, how they came to the space and what they found interesting in the beginning. What pulled you into fintech? What was your starting point?
I've always been interested in kind of what I call fringe markets, places where there's a big positional bet. So initially, what got me interested in fintech was I was doing my grad studies at MIT and just saw a lot of opportunity in kind of emerging commodity markets. And so I started a startup in that space. We were probably about 10 years too early in that market, but it taught me a lot of good, interesting lessons about how do you become regulated? What do fintechs need? How do you scale a business? And then started Zero Hash about 3 years ago.
So what was that first startup? What asset class was it focused on and what did it do?
Yeah, it was focused on a number of markets, including avocados, as well as maybe some more fringe markets such as industrial hemp. So industrial hemp is effectively legal cannabis in the United States. So it's actually federally legal. But obviously, there's this kind of very emotional, visceral reaction anytime you mention cannabis. And so the product that we launched was we were a CFTC-regulated marketplace, which is effectively the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, which is the federal regulator here in the United States. And we got regulated as an exchange to offer derivative contracts on CBD from industrial hemp. So CBD is one of the oils, one of the components of cannabis. And effectively, we were letting people take positional bets or allow, you know, farmers to hedge out their positions from cannabis farming, effectively. All federally legal. You know, we were so highly regulated, but yet people had this very emotional, visceral reaction. And it reminds me a lot of what was the case 3 years ago in digital assets or cryptocurrencies, where again, there were these kind of cheap jokes or comments around what this space actually was. And, you know, that drew me into it.
Yeah. And we will definitely get into detail on what you're doing now. I'm curious, as you were starting kind of your first entrepreneurial journey, it's quite, or maybe it wasn't your first, you tell me, but it's quite uphill to immediately launch a CFTC regulated venue. That must have been quite a climb.
Yeah, it was. And especially as a small company, I think the key takeaway for me was for financial services, for fintechs, right? Or any even just traditional businesses looking to get to market. With regulation, the start line is so much further away. The fixed cost is so much higher. And that means that, you know, we spent a year and a half getting regulated to really realize within probably 6 to 9 months that we were 10 years too early. But imagine if we'd been able to, you know, the old axiom, let's fail fast. It's really hard to fail fast in financial services if you have to get regulated, because you have to be regulated first in order to operate. And that's why I think, you know, what we're doing here at Zero Hash and others in other spaces, you know, brokerage as a service, banking as a service, has really allowed and driven a lot of innovation, because it allows entrepreneurs to get to market so much quicker and either fail fast or iterate even faster and be successful.
Yep. What does it mean to be 10 years too early? What were the signs of, you know, of a market not being mature? And I guess in this way, what are the signs of a market being ready?
Yeah, I mean, I think really it was just the ability to get traction from more established players, right? And to get volume that was meaningful, but also just looking at the horizon and looking at the pipeline. How close were we for this to become, you know, effectively $1 billion business? And obviously in the digital asset space, you've seen it very, you know, the last 12 months, this kind of momentum and shift occur. And part of it's that emotional feel, right? But, you know, you can also see tangible data points around it. You know, we just realized that there's nothing wrong with the market being not there necessarily yet, but what does it take for the dominoes to fall? And we realized that the dominoes were not going to fall for some time.
Gotcha. Yeah. So what was your transition like into crypto and digital assets from that, from your first company? How did you, I understand you recognize that it's a growing space and so on, but how did you narrow in on it? What were the things that, let's say, rhymed with the ways that you were thinking?
Yeah. So this was late, well, around 2017. So we sold the first business off, you know, with regulatory licensing, there is value. And so we were fortunate to make our investors some money. And, you know, we had to effectively transition that business across for a little bit of time, which created some thinking space. And digital assets, it was just around the first bull run in 2017. And we saw a lot of the same pieces. And so although we, in theory, had been burned by an emerging asset class, it was super exciting, right? It felt the dominoes are starting to fall here. And that's really what drove the desire to launch a business within digital assets. Again, we weren't necessarily absolutely right in terms of the product that was needed. We initially built the business to be a digital asset exchange. But, you know, if our thesis was that digital assets were going to become mainstream, effectively digital assets would be everywhere. Right, wherever you have a bank account, wherever you have a brokerage account. And so we started to say, why are we building a B2C business? Doesn't it make more sense if the adoption cycle is going to occur, if the dominoes are going to fall very quickly, this is going to be available everywhere. And so we shifted the business to become a B2B2C business. And so our clients are effectively builders, entrepreneurs, traditional players that have customers who want to launch a digital asset product, effectively through a couple of lines of code. And critically, going back to the conversation earlier, without the need to be regulated. And so we take on all regulatory burden around launching a digital asset product.
So I want to open up just some words that you're using to understand what the words mean. So first you said you were going to be an exchange. And so what do you mean by the word exchange? And then you also are using the word digital asset, which means a lot of different things to different people. So what is it that you mean by the word digital asset?
Yes, what we mean by digital asset, and again, the vernacular here matters, but we effectively are trying to cover the entire ecosystem. I think cryptocurrencies is a relatively narrow term. Our view on digital assets is that cryptography, blockchain, is a technology, right? And it can be used in anything, right? It can be used to tokenize gold. It can be used as a currency. It can be a piece of art. It can be an NFT gaming piece. And so what we're trying to say by digital asset is that it's much broader than just what people have perceived to be cryptocurrencies, you know, such as Bitcoin or Ethereum. And even there, people say, is Bitcoin a cryptocurrency? So historically, we've avoided the term cryptocurrency just because we feel that it's relatively narrow in terms of what it covers.
Gotcha. But are you talking about 2 years ago, if you were to say digital asset, what you really were saying is that we want to operate an ATS for securities. Is that what you mean? Or are you focused on kind of Web3 native?
We're saying absolutely anything that has cryptography at its heart or blockchain at its heart. That's effectively what we're trying to say. So actually, it's the reverse. So the only thing that we don't touch is security tokens. So we're not regulated by the SEC, and so our regulatory licensing is for what people term commodities. So at least in the United States, everything, and I mean absolutely everything, is either a commodity or a security. There is no in between, right? And so things like movie theater receipts or NFTs fall within the commodity framework. And so to regulators, we say we only touch commodity tokens or commodity digital assets, things that are built on the blockchain. So that's the definition that we use.
Gotcha. Awesome. Okay. So this makes sense. You've had this background in standing up a fintech that is CFTC regulated and is kind of commodity focused, and we're taking a similar view across the crypto asset class. And then can you talk a little bit about what it means for something to be an exchange? And I meditate here because, you know, for something to be an equities exchange is quite different for, you know, how Coinbase is structured is quite different for how a decentralized exchange might be structured. So can you talk us through what you mean there as well?
Yeah, sure. So what you meant by exchange was probably what people term electronic communication networks or ECNs in the FX space. So that's how we were really building the business, to more closely resemble the FX ecosystem. And that's actually, in hindsight, what allowed us to actually move into this B2B business relatively quickly. Because in the FX space, the matching system, right, the ability to match an order and to make it a trade, right, that is actually completely distinct from anything post-trade. And so we'd always fundamentally segregated in our infrastructure and technology stack the ECN infrastructure, i.e. the exchange infrastructure, away from the post-trade infrastructure, i.e. the custody, the legal movement, the transfers, the deposits, the withdrawals. And so that allowed us to move very quickly in kind of this B2B model. Aside from just the opportunity, we felt that it was important to close the exchange such that we had absolutely no channel conflict with our partners. So, you know, at the time, we actually made all the money from the exchange. And, you know, it was doing, you know, tens of millions of dollars a day. But we realized that the bigger play here was on the B2B infrastructure stack that we'd built for our own exchange and other groups wanting to launch digital asset products, an exchange, an app, a rewards product. And so we decided that to actually go to these groups and say, we are your true partner, we had to shut down the entity and the product that actually made us all of our money. But actually, in the long term, we felt would conflict with our partners and make the sale much, much harder.
Gotcha. So, okay, so we've got Zero Hash, and it is in the mold of the embedded finance movement, where, as you say, you can take an API integration and very quickly add digital assets as a business line to whatever it is that you're doing, whether it's, you know, getting people to buy some options and stocks, or whether it's getting some student loans, or whether it is payments and all the good stuff that's happening across the fintech bundles now. Can you tell us a little bit about the product itself and how it works?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's you described it pretty perfectly in the sense of it fits within this embedded finance system. So very similar to how banking as a service and brokerage as a service groups work. We are a pure API driven business, and we allow groups to launch, you know, whether it be the ability to, for example, buy and sell. So we have a liquidity service endpoint. We allow platforms to launch roundups. So if you have a debit or credit card and you want to allow your clients to round up to the nearest dollar, you can do that. If you want to, for example, issue crypto rewards. So if you issue a credit card and you collect interchange versus you giving people points, you can give people Bitcoin, for example. And so those are kind of some of the productizations that people can do with very dedicated endpoints. So for example, we have a dedicated rewards endpoint. We have a dedicated roundups endpoint. We have a dedicated buy and sell endpoint. Just from a structural perspective, the way that it works is that, you know, we use this term B2B2C. People sometimes use the term fully disclosed. So it's a fully disclosed model, which means that for legal purposes, i.e. for you to not be regulated as effectively the front end or the platform, the client needs to be Zero Hashes as well. So that's what we mean by fully disclosed or B2B2C. That doesn't mean that the clients actually ever interact with us. It means that the client's information is being shared with us and the client has signed our user agreement. But the beauty of it is that you are presenting out our user agreement as a tick box, and you would need to do the KYC on the client anyway. And so from the client's experience, it feels very much like a single onboarding, but legally it's two separate steps, right? You are being legally onboarded to our partner and you're being legally onboarded to us. Just from a UX experience, it feels very much one and the same.
You know, that's an industry structure that is a repeatable pattern. So for example, there are businesses called turnkey asset management platforms that have, you know, this type of shape where the TAMP has some particular investment products and really it markets to financial advisors who onboard their own client to the TAMP and hold the relationship and hold the brand, you know, but it's underneath it are the TAMP products. And it's also similar to some of the custodial models, again, where you might have the custodian running the funds or the money markets or the sweeps or the trading in some manner. And then you have brands you delegate to who have potentially a fiduciary responsibility or some other responsibility of that sort. In the case of Zero Hash, like what are you? What is the entity from a regulatory perspective? I know you've described it a bit, but I guess I'm trying to just map how something that might be merely like a distribution website or distribution app connects to you and sort of like what the relationships look like.
Yeah. So, you know, in very similar examples that you gave, I mean, we like to use examples, for example, banking as a service. So, for example, Cross River Bank powers a number of financial service companies or fintechs. And they allow them to launch current accounts. We allow people to launch effectively crypto accounts, the ability to buy and sell crypto accounts or to receive rewards or roundups, just as some examples. Just from a regulatory perspective, and we're talking about, you know, the challenge here is that we're talking about our partners now are global partners, and in each jurisdiction, they're slightly different vernacular. And even in the United States, where obviously we are headquartered, where we do most of our volume currently, we're also talking about every single state has slightly different definitions. And so in the United States, just to keep it somewhat narrow, we are a money service business at a FinCEN federal level. And then we have money transmission licenses effectively in each and every state. And then we also have a BIT license in the state of New York. And so it gets pretty complex, right? Because the US is this patchwork of regulation. And so we are effectively, and this is again, going back to your definition of what is digital assets, what are cryptocurrencies, at least in the United States, right now, any non-security token is deemed to be money. And therefore, you have to be a money transmitter. And that's how we currently fit in with the within the regulatory ecosystem in the United States. And the triggers for who is the money transmitter is effectively who is moving the funds, who is moving the Bitcoin from client A to client B, who is receiving the funds from client A. And all of this is, at the end of the day, I mean, from a crypto address, you're just presenting out a crypto address to the client. But legally, what matters is that that is a zero hash controlled address, right? And that is legally being custodied by zero hash. From a client experience standpoint, your entire interface, your entire ability to buy and sell remains very much with the platform where you already do everything else today.
Gotcha. Are there any requirements on the distributor? So if I, for example, as just an individual, wanted to set up a site that opened up accounts on behalf of Zero Hash, is that possible or do I need to be in some particular shape as well?
The broad answer is no, you don't need any other licensing. Now, New York is the one state where you just need to structure things carefully, because the way that people describe the United States is that it's 49 states plus New York. But yeah, in broad cases, you know, in 99% of cases, no, you don't need any additional licensing. And that's the beauty of it. You can get to market super quickly. Let me give you just one tangible example, one that's in the news today. So MoonPay. MoonPay just raised at a $3 billion valuation. We were their first partner when they were four people, right? So that's how we help businesses grow. We allowed them to get to market very quickly. And, you know, we provided that infrastructure to enable a startup to become now a very established player in the ecosystem. So that's just one example of how we work with very, very early stage companies, you know, four people, one idea. And then we work with very, very established companies, publicly listed companies now. And our system and our infrastructure can work with both. It's a very easy lift. Platforms to get up and running, you know, within a couple of days or weeks if they're slightly larger and have more complex processes.
So that's an interesting example. For whatever it is that you can share, of course, but where does MoonPay end and you start in terms of their servicing?
Yeah, so you can obviously read the user agreements. So everything I'm saying here is public. Effectively, in the United States, the crypto assets have to be at a regulated money transmitter. And so when you buy a Bitcoin, for example, off MoonPay, and you are in a state that is regulated, that legal transfer of the Bitcoin from MoonPay to you has to be done at a regulated money transmitter. And so we are legally transferring that ownership, and then that Bitcoin is legally coming from Zero Hash. Everything else around the front end experience remains very much with the partner. And so that's effectively how it sits. Anytime you touch crypto, that's effectively where Zero Hash comes into it.
Right. And I assume on their end, they're also the ones that are integrating to the payment processor to trigger the purchase, right? So
exactly. So if you look at, you know, we crisscross a number of verticals, right? So in the payment space, if you look at them on ramps and off ramps, and we service a bunch of them publicly. We've announced groups like Transact, Bankster, just thinking which ones we can and can't announce, but pretty much every single on ramp and off ramp leverages Zero Hash to access North America. Effectively, what they are doing is they are the merchant of record. And so they are taking all of the chargeback risk and they are providing the front end. And so when you swipe your credit card, the cash is being delivered into, for example, the Bankster's account or MoonPay's account or whoever it is. And effectively, what they're doing is they're fronting the Bitcoin, right? Because with credit card processing, it takes a couple of days for those funds to clear. And so they're fronting the cash effectively. So they're very cash intensive. On-ramps and off-ramps are very cash intensive businesses because you have to effectively give the Bitcoin immediately, even though you actually don't get the cash from the card processor immediately. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And so on your end, do you have to then like market make and keep a bunch of inventory? Or do you have third parties that do that on the platform?
Yeah, we don't take principal risk. So we basically back-to-back any trade immediately. And then we can have configurable things like configurable spreads, for example, if you want to adjust the spread that is being collected. We can do that. We'll collect the spread and remit it back to you in real time.
Gotcha. Are there any aggregate metrics that you've shared publicly or would be comfortable sharing just in terms of the scale of the company so that folks can get a sense for your, you know, for your volumes or maybe transactions or things of that nature?
Yeah. So we announced a couple of months ago that we are now consistently about 5% of the world's Ethereum transaction volume, on-chain transaction volume. So what we mean by that is the number of, you know, if you look at Etherscanner and you look at the number of on-chain transactions, either deposit or withdrawal, we account for 5% of that. And the reason we like that number is because Ethereum on-chain processing at scale is complex, right? Because Ethereum, just the way it's structured, is sequentially processed. And so to do that across dozens of different platforms at the scale that we're doing it for millions of clients and clients, that is a complex thing to do. So that means that 1 in 20 transactions flows through ZeroHash in some way. I think that really places ZeroHash, especially in Ethereum, right, at the heart of a lot of very, very interesting things being done as part of Web 3.0.
Gotcha. Yeah, just trying to contextualize that a little bit. I mean, I think there are probably conclusions you can make then about the amount of volume that's involved in kind of like on-ramp issuance versus the volume that's involved in sort of secondary transactions. Or maybe another way to think about it is also, you know, there's different parts of the ecosystem where people do things, right? So there are the sort of vertically integrated crypto exchanges, and then there's the decentralized exchanges on Web3 itself. And then there is this growing component or growing share of fintechs as having integrated multi-line fintechs user footprints that are now integrating crypto into them. So in a way, you could almost guesstimate that something like 5 to 10% of Ethereum flow is now happening through traditional fintech footprints.
Yeah, I mean, I think again, it's all down to definitions. But I mean, so with the on-ramps and off-ramps, effectively every transaction equates to a withdrawal, right? It's what people termed non-custodial, right? So you'll, for example, swipe your debit card or credit card or use ACH. You will effectively buy an Ethereum and you'll send it immediately to a smart contract, for example. That is very, very different to the flows and the numbers and the metrics that we have, for example, with some of our broker-dealers. So there's lots of trades, but very few withdrawals. Right. And so that's very similar to like a centralized exchange where there's a lot of off-chain ledgering relative to the volume is high versus the on-chain volume. So it really depends on what part of the landscape that you're looking
at. Gotcha. Yep. And then I think I asked this, but I don't know if I asked it well, but I guess where do you source the liquidity? If we think of these things as withdrawals to on-chain wallets, where are you sourcing the liquidity
from? We source it from liquidity providers. So we don't really route to exchanges. We route to liquidity providers. There's no payment for order flow, nothing like that. It's simply multiple liquidity providers that are streaming into us and we will get the best X from those liquidity providers. So we'll smart order route to those different LPs.
Gotcha. Okay. That model makes total sense. And I think there's something nice about folks who run kind of a best execution type environment rather than trying to do everything vertically. I think it's a model that makes a lot of sense. And it also makes sense that you have lots and lots of kind of integration partners. I guess one last question around this set of topics is, how do you think about asset coverage? Because there are many, many assets and there are different ways to be integrated. And there's sort of different levels of technical capacity that's required in order to do so, right? In some cases, you want to run a big node infrastructure. In other cases, you might be fine to just mediate on top of somebody else's. So what does it mean for an asset to be available on your system? Like, what does it mean for there to be an account on your system?
An account simply means that somebody can deposit, withdraw, and be transferred value in some way, right? But whether it be a trade, or whether it be a roundup, or whether it be anything else. It also means that we can custody assets for those people. So for example, we can custody an NFT for a client built on the Ethereum blockchain, for example. That's what we mean by account. In terms of the second part of your question was around...
Yeah, so I guess it's like, how technical is the stack? Like, are you running a bunch of nodes, or is there sort of like, you know, a wallet provider that you partner with? Or I guess, because like, do you have a Cardano and an Avalanche and a Solana node and an Ethereum node and Polygon and Arbitrum, or there, what is it that is underneath the hood?
Yeah, so I mean, part of it, right, is you know, whether or not you use a third-party wallet technology provider, there's a lot of things that have to be, a stack that has to be built on top of that. When we first started, we used technology providers downstream a lot more, but we've realized that we can take a lot of that in-house, and it also matters because a lot of these groups were not built for the type of throughput that we're talking about. And I gave you some of the statistics around Ethereum, for example. A lot of these groups don't want to launch assets that quickly. We think it's super important. So we now support close to 50 different assets. And so we maintain our full nodes for two main reasons. One is so that we have control over the assets that we want to launch. And two, to be able to scale the way that we need to be able to scale. And I think it's really, really important. You asked for some statistics that we can share publicly. I'll give you some public stats from Tastyworks, which is one of the largest US broker-dealers that is now owned by IG Capital, which is a FTSE 250 company. And think of them as a very traditional broker. So think of, as you think about Charles Schwab entering the space, the E-Trades entering the space, how will they start to look at this space? And I think this is a great case study for that. So Tasty launched crypto 6 months ago. They were very clear they wanted to launch with four assets. What people term the big four, right? Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin, and Bitcoin Cash. And that's how they started. And then very quickly, they realized the demand for more assets. So today they support 21 different assets. And that's in 6 months. And within 6 months, they've gone from effectively 100% of their volume being Bitcoin and ETH to 56% last month coming from Bitcoin and ETH. And within 6 months of trading or launching trading, and these they have hundreds of thousands of what I would call very traditional investors, 15% of their existing customer base has now bought or sold digital assets. And just to show you how large and traditional these groups are, or these kind of people are, they're natural persons typically, the typical trade size at Tastyworks is now $8,000. So every trade that occurs is on average $8,000. And so those should give you some stats. And so when we think about new assets, we're saying, wow, even the least crypto native groups, right, that just entered the space, they very quickly want more assets, and their clients statistically also want many more assets. And so the innovation in this space is super important. And I think as an infrastructure provider, we've really got to be there. And we've also got to be agnostic, right? So as we talk about NFTs, we think it's super important to support all of the main chains that are, you know, being leveraged right now. So we don't pick winners. We support Ethereum. We support Solana. We support Polygon Matic. And we let our clients choose where they want to do things.
Right. That's fantastic. It makes sense. You know, my question's coming from the perspective of it is substantially difficult to support any of these chains. You know, it is at least months of work and very, very highly skilled and in-demand people. And so I think it just points to that infrastructure being quite important and quite valuable. Can you talk a little bit about psychology, and in particular, the psychology of the types of folks who are now your clients? And what I mean is, let's say the last 5 years, if not 12, have been a journey for many people in and around finance, in and around media, as well as sort of the derivative industries around that, to oppose, struggle with, and eventually come around to the normalization of digital assets in a client portfolio. Like, this is just a thing that people have now. This is just like what kids are doing on Twitter, and there's only so much yelling into the wind that you can do before you realize maybe stop the yelling. And I guess I'm very interested, especially in that person or business owner or traditional finance investor at the edge, the person who's, you know, still skeptical and doesn't really want to bother with this stuff, but, you know, the light bulb is just going off because you can't ignore it anymore. And I would imagine that your business interacts with people like that all the time. And so I guess my question is just to riff on the change that you've seen, you know, since you've started the business, in the tenor of the conversation that you're having with people, in the language that they choose, in how they think about the world, in how they think about their business. Like, what has that journey been like?
Yeah, I mean, I like to break this down into a quadrant, right, in terms of how people perceive their own decisions and even my own. And so I think, you know, if you look at a quadrant and you say, and on the x-axis, you have, how do people perceive my decision, right? Did people laugh at it? Either they thought it was a crappy decision, or did they think it was a great decision? And then on the y-axis, you have, was the idea, did it actually transpire to be a good idea, or was it actually a bad idea? Where most people do not want to be is they don't want to be in a position where everyone told them it was a crappy idea and it turns out to be a crappy idea, right? But the real innovation occurs when everybody laughs at you and says it's a crappy idea and it turns out to be a brilliant idea. And it's quite interesting when you just think of decision-making through those lenses, how I think it gives a lot of clarity into how people perceive things, especially in kind of this market. I would say that it's night and day, right? And you can look at this. You can look at people who have been very public in dismissing digital assets. If you look at JP Morgan, for example, and how they do a complete shift. I would say that most conversations now that we have are not whether crypto in and of itself is a bad idea, whether crypto in itself is a bad asset to have. I think the conversations are a lot more nuanced now. So when we talk to a lot of the neobanks as to how they think about digital assets and productization around digital assets, they say, hey, do you know what? We serve low FICO score clients. We serve as the 70% of Americans that do not have $1,000 for an unknown event. Do we really want to be offering crypto trading to these clients? Right? That's the question. It's not whether crypto in itself is a bad asset. And I think that's a really, really interesting point. And I actually think it's actually a good question. And I don't think that just extends to crypto. I think that extends to stock trading or whatever else. And that's why I think productization beyond just buy and sell is so important. Because the counter argument to that is to say, well, do you know what? 10 years ago, $10 worth of Bitcoin is now worth $10 million. But also wealth aggregation is actually what causes the biggest discrepancy in people being able to get out of this situation, right? If you look at the stock market and how it's performed, the people who held stocks are the people that benefited. 70% of people who don't have $1,000 and therefore they really don't have any stocks because it's not being done easily for them have really suffered. And when you convert the conversation into that process and you say, let's productize in a slightly different way, let's productization in rewards. And that could be stock-backed rewards, right? A fraction of a stock or a fraction of a Bitcoin. I think people really buy into it. And I'm just giving you one example, right, of how people's perceptions have changed. It's not that everyone's jumping into crypto and saying we have to absolutely have crypto on our platform. They're saying there's a valid question about it now. How do we do it that best aligns with our current customer base? And the neobanks are one that I find really, really personally quite interesting.
That's a fascinating framing. I think there's such a fundamentally, you know what it's like? It's you're hiking somewhere and you see a gigantic rock face. And in the rock face, there are striations of the different colors of the stone, you know, and it's bright red and then it's dark brown and it's black and then it's sandy. And you can see time passing. You can see the eras defined in the stone itself and how the sediment stacks. And I feel like when you look at what's happened with certainly the broader internet culture and the broader socioeconomic situation, but more specifically in finance, you have these unbelievably stark striations in terms of what people were trying to build. And then when the new thing happened, you know, and it's going from the electronification of markets and IT in the back office wearing the brown tie to, you know, the fintech distribution layer owning the customer relationship to now the digital asset class offering the alpha exposure and the actual opportunity. And I think it's very hard to bridge between these two things, but we're finally in a place where the story is so bright and so clear that even when left to the pure profit motive, there's no choice but to start thinking about these issues.
100%. And I think going back to that quadrant, at this point, a lot of people are saying that it's a good idea to offer crypto at this point because there's real data points, right? So if you look at Robinhood's financials, I actually think Robinhood is a closer competitor to most crypto companies than to a lot of traditional brokerages. I mean, that gives you a real data point. If you're a brokerage firm, if you're a payment firm, you look at Square. So as a lot of these companies now are going public or, you know, through a SPAC, and so a lot of this information is now coming to the fore, there's a lot of these data points. And so everyone now thinks it's a good idea to offer crypto. It not only is just from a revenue perspective, it's from a cost of acquisition of customers, from a retention engagement perspective of customers. There's all of these data points that can now be used, which makes the sell, so to speak, so much easier. But I also think that point of, you know, groups like Robinhood, which are traditional companies entering the space, this is why I think channel conflict, which I alluded to earlier in the conversation, is so important. Because every traditional financial services firm, to your point, is looking at crypto and will become a crypto company in some form. Every crypto company is now looking at traditional financial services. So for example, Coinbase now giving you the ability to deposit, you know, your paycheck into Coinbase. And so this concept that crypto and traditional finance are not one and the same, I think is relatively anachronistic. And I think that also changes the way that people think about how they launch crypto as well and the partners that they use from an infrastructure perspective. And that's why I think that channel conflict point is so, so important. And something that we mention as, you know, as a key differentiator around Zero Hash versus some other providers.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, especially in the institutional world. I think in the populist, permissionless, decentralized world, there are still a lot of lessons to learn, but I totally agree with you on the prior. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. I wanted to land us on your view of the company, you know, sort of like what's the maximal view of the company as you see it, in the sense that, like, is there a version of the world where, you know, like Fiserv or FIS, you're providing all access to digital assets across all the financial institutions? Like, how do you see your company growing? And I think embedded into that question is also a question about the nature of the services you're providing as things shift from being largely a financial asset to increasingly being a functional asset that is participatory.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that our thesis, and hopefully this plays out, right, is very simple. Every financial services company will have some form of digital asset product within the next 18 months. And then I think if you look more broadly and you buy into embedded finance, I think that as groups start to embed traditional financial services, they are 100% going to start to embed digital assets. And so in theory, you know, the optimal state, you know, coattailing on embedded finance is that every company in some form interacts with digital assets. And we're already starting to see that. A lot of the buy now, pay later firms are now starting to offer check-in and savings account. And very much as a concurrent thing, they also want to offer crypto, right? And so that's why people start to deem these things the super apps, because they'll offer everything in one place. That's how I think that this space evolves. And I think that ties even more broadly into, as these become, you know, functional assets, so to speak, every company will interact with them in some way. And you're already starting to see that on the tip of the spear, right? If you look at gaming companies and others, they're already interacting with Zero Hash. And I think as you get a much broader, you'll start to see, you know, you're starting to see shoe companies like Nike, right, start to offer NFTs for the metaverse. And so again, hopefully those types of companies will interact with Zero Hash. So the optimal state, and to not sound too grandiose, is, but I think there's a lot of things that we can coattail on, you know, the creator economy, the metaverse, increase in adoption of Web3 applications, is that Zero Hash becomes an infrastructure provider for effectively every company with a customer base out there.
Fantastic. That's awesome. I hope it happens. If folks want to learn more about Zero Hash or to find you, where should they go?
Yeah, just very easily. You just go to www.zerohash.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn, which is just Edward Woodford.
Edward, thank you so much for stopping by and telling us your story.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, everyone. That's it for this week's episode of the FinTech Blueprint. For more technical deep dives into all things fintech and decentralized finance, check out fintechblueprint.com and grab a free subscription to the newsletter. This is Lex, and I'll see you next time.